In Colombia, the problem's even worse. If you, the equivalent of 1.3 to 1.5 million people are losing their jobs, their livelihoods as farmers in Colombia, what are they going to dedicate themselves to? Cocoa, the most profitable crop you can dedicate yourself to in Colombia. If we really concerned ourselves about the drug war, if we really think that's a problem, we would probably do well to not make licit means of income improbable. We would do well to allow people to continue on as small farmers. So this same trade model is expanding further southward as more and more people are coming northward. So we're asking that it's not that hard. Call your congresspeople. Tell them to come out publicly against the Peru and the Colombia Free Trade Agreements. It's really basic. Get other people to do the same. There's information back there on that table as well. A couple other things are we just want to get more people talking about the roots of migration, getting people to talk about migration other than like a wall or not a wall, getting to go to the root of the problem. Why are people coming here? And talking about some of the things that Miguel was talking about tonight, talking about free trade agreements. We have a simple way of doing it. You can contact the guy we've got in D.C., and he'll email you a bunch of materials, such as fact sheets and sign-up sheets and invitations, and even recipes. Because the idea is that you invite a bunch of friends over for dinner, and you have a solidarity dinner, and you get together and you talk about the roots of migration. And so it's really easy. It's usually pretty fun. And if you like beans and rice, it's a good time. And so thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you so much for giving your time.
That was Ben Beachy of Witness for Peace, preceded by the featured speaker Miguel de la Rosa of Educa in Oaxaca, Mexico, translated by Todd Miller. You can find out more about Witness for Peace and how to join their delegations on the web at witnessforpeace.org. Thanks to Lenore McGarry and Lori Konwinski for their assistance with this segment. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Now a look at the other side of the coin, on the other side of the border. When the Oaxacans you have seen through Miguel's eyes, a vibrant people, fighting for culture, community, and dignity at home, come north to become nameless, faceless, and expendable. Our context will be the recent wildfires that ravaged the border county of San Diego in California, and a debriefing of local activists that took place on November 1st, brought to us by Global Voices for Justice.
I'm Stuart Hay. The devastating fires of Southern California in late October 2007, especially in San Diego County, scorched 500,000 acres, destroyed 2,300 structures, and displaced several hundred thousand people. This disaster brought two distinct images to mind. The causes were the same as San Diego's 2003 fires, and the government's emergency response was a virtual replica of New Orleans after the Katrina devastation. Mostly public relation work by spin doctors, distracting from the inaction of the government through photo ops of state and federal officials with people who had lost their entire livelihood. In this talk by Mike Davis, Justin Akers Chacon, and Enrique Morones, we will hear another side of the story, one that mainstream media did not want to cover. Mike Davis is a renowned analyst of environmental issues from a socialist perspective. He's a professor of urban theory and history and teaches at the University of California, Irvine. He is author of many books, including City of Courts, Ecology of Fear, and his most recent, In Praise of Barbarians, published in August 2007.
It's always an honor to speak to San Diego's community of activists. A great pleasure that you're all here tonight, because we really need to have a dialogue about the events of the last 10 days. But before I talk about, give you my spiel about the fires, I wanted to read a really interesting letter that was sent to me by Paul Harris. Paul was in the Superdome during Katrina week. He's from here, from San Diego, and he's writing a book about his week. And with his permission, I want to read one of the two letters that he's written to the Union Tribune, because I think they're, in some ways, the most eloquent and important thing I've heard in the last 10 days. Letter to the editor, California Wildfires. Well, I'm in strong agreement with Robert Caldwell's opinion piece, Tale of Two Cities, in terms of the response to our wildfires being very good overall. I find it preposterous to even try and compare the fires, or more specifically, Qualcomm Stadium, to the Superdome. I'm so thankful that lessons were learned and that those at Qualcomm had the comforting, supportive conditions, and thankful for the humanitarian spirit there. I was a San Diego tourist stuck in the Superdome, and maybe you aren't aware, Mr. Caldwell, that the airport, Amtrak, Greyhound were all closed 2 days prior to the hurricane and before the mandatory evacuation. Many of us had no way out. Maybe you weren't aware that all that 99% of talk of murder and rape in the Superdome was simply rumor. There were deaths inside the Superdome, one suicide and about 10 medical-related deaths, because necessary emergency supplies were prohibited from entering. 98% of us evacuees, or refugees as the press called us, well-behaved and looked out for one another and did our best to survive under horrific conditions. No running water, toilets overflowing at day two of 6 days, 95-degree temperature with 90% humidity, sleeping on urine and feces-soaked cardboard, and a severe lack of National Guardsmen because so many were in Iraq. Maybe you weren't aware that Mayor Nagin was actually stationed next door to the Superdome pretty much 24 hours a day and repeatedly asked for federal assistance. You would now think, of course, that Ray Nagin lives in San Diego for the frequency with which his name is abused and he's denounced on certain papers and television channels. And Mayor Nagin repeatedly asked for federal assistance because as awful as our wildfires were, they were a drop in the bucket comparison to Katrina and the floods. Roughly 200 times as many people died from Katrina. Roughly 100 times as many homes were lost to Katrina. We're in 2 to 3 feet of water all around the Superdome, so supplies were more difficult to get to us than Mission Valley. Nevertheless, this was a moot point because hundreds of potential rescuers, the Red Cross, churches, and caring citizens with boats were prohibited from entering the city by various state and federal entities. And as corrupt of a political history as New Orleans has, it takes some real nerve on your part to declare that New Orleans possesses far too little of the civic glue that holds communities together. As caring as San Diegans were for one another, I would dare match New Orleans citizens one-on-one with ours any day. Many of us don't even know our neighbors. And as an aside, the most looting I was an eyewitness to, which was overblown by the media, was committed by more well-to-do white individuals. The bottom line is that if the devastation from our wildfires was magnified 10, 20, or in the case of Katrina, 100 times, would you still say it should or could it have been handled by our local authorities? Sincerely, Paul Harris. Paul, thank you very much for writing this letter. The most heartbreaking sign I've ever seen in California is at Doghouse Junction, near the summit of fire-scarred Otay Mountain. Okai is that mountain just south of San Miguel that squats right on the border. The sign is a simple, chilling image of a family desperately fleeing flames. Anyone likely to encounter the sign, which is primarily border patrolmen or their elusive furtive prey, will instantly understand its meaning. People running from fire. People burn here. Otay Mountain and its sister, border-straddling massive to the east, Tecate Peak, offer refuge to unique species of legally protected trees, birds, and butterflies. But the militarization of the border, along with the recent wildfires, have so defaced the landscape that it's very difficult to recognize its underlying natural beauty. True, the sweeping views of San Diego, Tijuana, and their utterly entangled destinies remain superb. But otherwise, Doghouse Junction looks like a NATO firebase in the Pamirs. A crude helicopter landing pad, a bunker, it's actually a relic of World War II, which always, or most of the time, I go up to Otay Mountain, there's a mysterious black dog tethered to a chain. And I've never quite understood the meaning of this, whether this is a joke or the dog is actually some supernatural presence that's endowed this place with the name Doghouse Junction. You occasionally see National Guard Humvees and always ever-lurking green and white Migra SUVs. The real Afghanistan, by the way, is located only 20 miles further east of Otay Mountain at La Posta, a mountain warfare training facility where the Navy SEALs based in Coronado have to matriculate before they're deployed to fight the Taliban. San Diego's backcountry apparently looks a lot like Afghanistan. The Otay Tacati Wilderness has become Tijuana's back door to San Diego. Now that the front door at San Ysidro has been bolted shut by Operation Gatekeeper and the Bush administration's absolutely superlative re-erection of the Berlin Wall, if you look at a road map from the perspective of labor migrants, the San Diego Mountains seem an obvious alternative to facing death by first in the Imperial Desert or southern Arizona. The promised land of construction jobs and sweatshops is enticingly close at hand, and a greenhorn would easily underestimate the terrain. In fact, the real choice that migrants face is between furnace and labyrinth. Except when one of their helicopters crash, which occurs actually with a startling frequency, La Migra aren't crazy enough to descend into the treacherous maze of inaccessible canyons and deep ravines through which the coyotes guide their clients. They simply park in the truck trails and wait for people to emerge from the shadows, just like lazy hunters jack-lighting deer. Sometimes they're joined by their unsolicited allies and fans, the Minutemen Project and its feral splinter groups, now including a few gun-toting loners who permanently stalk the border. As we all know, scores of immigrants, or more, have died in recent years in the San Diego Mountains, some from falls, some from dehydration and sheer exhaustion, some in snowstorms in the higher mountains to the east, and others casually murdered for the ease and profit of their guides. But the most excruciating death, and the one as a lifelong hiker in San Diego and California I've always feared the most, is the wildfire that can suddenly overtake its victims in a few minutes or stalk their desperate running figures for hours before they stumble, writhing into the infernal brush. The border mountains are highly combustible, and 4 years ago, a devastating firestorm, part of the 15 blaze complex that's now officially been dubbed the Fire Siege of 2003 by the state forestry people. One of these blazes scourged Otay Mountain and its rare cypress forest. Those of you who are outdoors types probably know that Otay and Tacati Peak support what ecologists call a refugia. It's a place where the ice age vegetation of the San Diego area has retreated in. And they're these, like the Torrey Pines. These are Tacati cypresses. The only place in the world they exist are on the top of these mountains, and I believe in one location in Baja California, along with lots of other absolutely unusual plants, butterflies. Even the geology is quite extraordinary. The 2003 fire burnt almost all of Otay Mountain. It also burned into the gorge of the Tijuana River. All this burnt. But the 2003 fire spared the terrain to its east. Most of Tacati Peak and the series of small valleys and mountains, you know, Potrero, that stretch further east through Barrett Lake, Marino, toward Campbell, and ultimately Acumba. But on Sunday, October 21st, exactly as predicted by most meteorologists, gale-force Anna and winds produced an eerie reprise of the 2003 conflagration. And I'm sure you've probably seen these satellite images, stunning images of 15 giant smoke columns blown far out into the Pacific. Indeed, from space, all of Southern California from Point Doom south seemed to be sending smoke signals to the moon. Yet from most newsrooms and editorial desks, which might as well be on the moon, only the celebrity evacuations in Malibu and later the mass exodus of population from the affluent, heavily Republican suburbs in northern San Diego County were deemed worthy of bold black headlines. The Harris Fire, centered on the Tacati-Potrero Valley area, in a largely blue-collar backcountry in which I grew up that has been stereotyped for decades as San Diego's Appalachia, as well as an infamous immigrant corridor. The Harris Fire tended to rate only whispers and grudging end-of-article references in the Southern California media, particularly when it approached that very expensive community that replaced what was once the beautiful the San Miguel Ranch or the Monte Vista Ranch. You started seeing a lot more news about the Harris Ranch when it got near, what is it, San Diego Estates or something like that that's been built there. I tend to cover my eyes when I drive by. Yet the greatest and most gruesome human tragedy, the firewake, took place in the early hours of the Harris Fire on Sunday, west of Potrero and along the flanks of Tecate Peak. First, on the southeast side, the fire roared with little warning into the U.S. hamlet of Tecate, the little cluster of houses on the side. Tecate, of course, is now the Mexican side, a big city, but this is the customs post and a few homes. It came in so fast that the immigration officials at the gate actually had to flee for their lives. And a middle-aged man, Thomas Varshak, was burnt to death while saving the life of his teenage son. And somewhere in the vicinity, and I've been unable to find the exact location, it doesn't seem to have been reported yet, four firefighters trying to make a stand were overrun by the flames. I think they're all still in UCSD burn ward, one of them in critical condition. But at the same time, or possibly a little earlier, possibly a little later, but on Sunday, on the northern flanks of Tecate Peak, the fire front engulfed what has been variously described as either a migrant camp or a large group of immigrants crossing the border. Perhaps it was both. 11 people, hideously burned, managed to reach the highway, or were later discovered by the Border Patrol. They're hospitalized still at the UCSD Medical Center's burn ward, the only such facility we possess in San Diego County, by the way. Four of them, including a married couple from Guerrero, a young man from Guerrero, and a guy from Chiapas, remain in critical condition, desperately fighting for their lives. They were found on Sunday. On Thursday, Border Patrol agents discovered four charred bodies, three men and a woman, and the remains of yet more victims may be discovered in the coming weeks in these funeral pyres of Chaparral and Oak. The number of the injured, probably much higher than what has so far been acknowledged in the English language press. Yesterday, La Pinon reported, after talking to the California Office of Emergency Services and a Border Patrol spokesman, that, quote, at least 50 of the 130 people injured by the fire were undocumented immigrants found by the Border Patrol, quote. Indeed, the brief abandonment of the border post at Tecate, when the agents were forced to flee from the flames, apparently set off a high-level red alert. And about 100 National Guardsmen and some Border Patrol were quickly dispatched to bring to reseal the border. According to the Los Angeles Times, 26th of October, quote, more than 200 migrants in the area, some, quote, smoked out of the ravines, were arrested by agents. So there were mass arrests, at least 200 people. Tijuana Papers, El Mexicano, reports that Grupos Beta, the elite Mexican police who patrol the border, rescued 50 other people who were trapped by flames. The fire burnt into the Mexican side of the flanks of Tecate Peak. At the same time, immigration agents became conspicuous at fire zone roadblocks throughout the county. Thus, the fire, combined with the meager presence, achieved the same local ethnic cleansing for which angry homeowners and San Diego nativists have been clamoring for so long. It was also reported to La Pinon by El Comité Amigos Americanos de San Diego that many farm workers, mostly indigenous Oaxaqueños, in the Rancho Penasquitas area, not only were not evacuated from the path of the fire at the time when everybody else was fleeing their SUVs to L.A. or to at Qualcomm, not only not evacuated, but were ordered to keep picking tomatoes. So let me try and summarize this horror. You have at least four immigrants burnt to death, as well as one resident of Tecate. You have at least four immigrants who are presently right now close to death, along with one of the four injured firefighters. You have seven other immigrants who are in the burn ward, several dozen more reported injured, hundreds arrested, and perhaps 1,000 or several thousand driven out of their informal housing. So let me repeat. This is the central human tragedy of the recent fires. But how has it been reported in local media? If such a thing as a negative Pulitzer Prize existed, it would undoubtedly be won by the heroic San Diego Union-Tribune, whose headline last Thursday warned, quote, "Criminals use fire to their advantage." The inflammatory first paragraph of this article by Chet Barfield read, "Burglaries of evacuated homes, cars belonging to residents who are fleeing the fires being broken into, thieves stealing supplies to relief victims." What image springs to your mind? The same kind of things that were said about New Orleans. But Barfield, as is so often typical of Union Tribune reporters, provided no evidence whatsoever of widespread looting. Indeed, he relied strictly on what he admitted were anecdotes emailed to the Union Tribune. Any of you read the Union Tribune email responses, you know what those tend to be like. The case of one Tribune reporter who claimed that her evacuated home had been burglarized, and two cases, reported cases in the Ramona area. And when Barfield asked San Diego police spokesman Monica Munoz about the crime wave, she told him, quote, "The department had had no official reports of fire-related burglaries. Although five arrests have been made since Sunday for minor violations such as interfering with an officer or being in a restricted area." Five arrests? This deserves black bold type and headlines designed to scare us out of our pants? So Barfield's last resort, his final card, was to write the following. "However, six people were caught stealing relief supplies yesterday from Qualcomm Stadium. An evacuee reported seeing them load two pickups in a car with cots and other items, leave and then return." Quote, unequivocal. He doesn't say alleged to have stolen. He says caught stealing. So the UT, together with the local television stations owned by Rupert Murdoch, or as in the case of KSUI, ever wonder why you see Duncan Hunter all the time on KSUI? His campaign manager owns the station. So the UT and the yellow TV stations then proceeded to give large quantities of gasoline to the internet arsonists who were busy spreading bogus tales of Mexicans with Molotov cocktails and Mecha burning Orange County. With these wildly inaccurate tale of Mexicans looting Qualcomm Stadium. In fact, as La Opinión, the infinitely more responsible Spanish language daily in Los Angeles, pointed out, the actual incident was a misunderstanding over diapers, no less, although it led to several deportations by conveniently available immigration agents. The following Sunday, last Sunday, Bob Kittle tried to exculpate his paper from the mess it had created with a remarkable editorial that concluded that the events in Qualcomm were a muddle. And like Werner Heisenberg discovering the principle of uncertainty in quantum physics, he said that nobody really knew whether or not anything had been stolen, nor for that matter whether any of the illegal aliens had started any of the fires. That might yet turn out to be the case. It might not be. We just don't know. This is all about, allegations and scare headlines that originated in the UT itself. But if Kittle had doubts about whether there were looters in Qualcomm or the city was being struck by a crime wave, the UT had no doubts at all about the larger meaning of the Holocaust in Tecate Mountain. Yesterday, in an article titled 11 and 18 in Burn Unit Undocumented, UCSD cases put focus on who pays for care, reporters Cheryl Clark and Leslie Berenstein emphasized the burden that emergency care for undocumented immigrants imposes on local hospitals and taxpayers. And they gave a pulpit Tamar Krikorian, the spokesman for an anti-immigrant group, who railed against the Mexican government, whom he claims should pay for any injury, quote, to people who are sneaking across the border at the time of injury and clearly don't have any business here. The article, and this was the first separate piece, first time UT had printed more than a paragraph about the people who were died, burned, injured, and arrested in the Harris fire. What are we to believe? Local taxpayers and long-suffering health maintenance organizations are the true victims of the fire? Badly burned Mexicans cost us money? It's not surprising that the right-wing blogosphere immediately was filled with hosannas to the UT, revealing that at last we knew the secret of unaffordable health care in the United States. In fact, what this kind of article exposes is the real meaning of the stolid middle-class values that the UT has been celebrating for the last 10 days. And every Republican from the president on down to the Republican dog catcher has been celebrating with big smiles, turning this whole tragedy into a campaign rally. But the real values are the bigotry, the selfishness, and the manipulated rage that glue together Republican ideology from Rancho Santa Fe to the White House. If there was ever a time for San Diego progressives to unite and fight against the Copley monopoly, and of course KPBS is virtually a non-profit division of the Union Tribune, you can hear Bob Kittle giving us what we should believe is even more frequently in KPBS than in the editorial pages of the Union Tribune. To fight against the Copley monopoly, against the corrupt Republican establishment that pins medals on itself for its supposed leadership in allowing almost 4,000 homes to burn in the last 4 years, and against the invisible government of billionaire developers whose greed puts us all in harm's way. I mean, the time to do that is now. The pain of the 1,100 or so families who lost homes, but with only two exceptions, did not lose lives, and the largely affluent suburbs affected by the Witch Creek fire, should not be used as an excuse to blot out the deeper tragedy, the Harris fire, or obscure the trampling of human rights by federal and local officials. It is intolerable to think that the only monument to the Harris victims will be that sinister little sign on the top of Otay Mountain. The inviolable historical law of fire in Southern California is not that the experience of catastrophic residential fire almost never leads people to vote for restricting growth or not replacing homes and structures in areas that burn every 5 years like the Malibu coast. It's actually the contrary. Rebuilding is usually a process of gentrification, as it's been in Malibu and so many other places, where after fire, renters are forced out. Agriculture and citrus, which once created a buffer zone between us and the chaparral, there weren't fires like this before 1950. It moves out. The homes get bigger. So there is no learning curve. In a sense, we become stupider as a civilization the more we burn. San Diego's experience is absolutely the paradigm here. After the 2003 fire, so discussed at our San Diego City Fire Chief that he resigned after years of futilely asking for resources that would just bring us up to the minimal standard of other cities. The Rural Lands Initiative, which was a very interesting coalition of East County hillbillies like me and environmentalists, was absolutely crushed at the ballot. This would have implemented where you're only allowed to build one home per 100 acres. Would have preserved the quality of rural life and our natural landscape. It was just crushed by ads supposedly sponsored by small farmers in the back county. And as the Reader showed in one of the brilliant power structure analysis that it's famous for, it was entirely funded by the big developers. But the thing you need to be aware of is the developers have come up with the ultimate absurdity, which is the shelter-in-place plan that the county supervisors have adopted against immense grassroots opposition, mainly from people like firefighters and residents. And shelter in place is the idea that you can build new communities in backland cul-de-sacs at the bottom of canyons and the most remote parts of the county. The shelter-in-place plan, which is now officially adopted, is going to lead to a huge acceleration of growth. The idea is that when fire comes, homeowners in their fireproof homes will stay there, and firefighters will defend the community perimeter. And as people have pointed out in the opposition to it, this is just an almost homicidal policy. What is the logic of the policy? Well, one, that it expands potential growth, allows it to intrude into the truly wild areas that remain. And secondly, it saves developers the cost of building the secondary roads that are necessary for the safe and quick evacuation for such communities. But hey, isn't that what San Diego politics is all about? Helping the bottom line of developers?
That was author and scholar Mike Davis of University of California, Irvine.
Justin Akers Chacon is professor of U.S. history and Chicano studies at City College of San Diego. He is a co-author with Mike Davis of No One Is Illegal.
I don't know about you, but when this whole tragedy started, when I turned on the TV and I saw George Bush and Arnold Schwarzenegger cheerfully scampering over the smoldering ruins of people's houses, I thought something is truly wrong here. In fact, it inspired me to go try to find out for myself what was really happening, and I spent the week trying to investigate as much as I could firsthand. And what was really happening was that the heavy hand of the new Jim Crow was clearly at work in San Diego during this evacuation, during this whole crisis. I just want to try to point out a few things which I think will help us understand and frame this whole catastrophe, the deeper competing forces at work in our society. On the one hand, we're living through the era of neoliberalism, the conscious starving of the public sector, the Social Security net, so that we can redistribute wealth back to the top, where it ultimately will trickle down to us in a much better form. We also see the relocation of society's resources towards the institutions of repression and war. A war abroad, a war in Iraq, and the internal refraction of that war here in the United States, the war on immigrants. In fact, it stands in stark contrast. The way that we've spent billions of dollars fighting wars and militarizing our border. In the last 10 years, there's been the doubling of border agents. There's been the dramatic expansion of the internal repressive apparatus in the form of the Department of Homeland Security. And in fact, whenever there's money needed for war or for repression, there's an endless pocket. But when there's money needed for fire prevention, new fire trucks, well, the budgets run dry. We now spend, just as a side note, we now spend more money on what are called national defense projects, which include border militarization. We spend about $58 billion a year, which, if you put that into context of the global military spending, we spend more just on things like border militarization than other countries like Great Britain spend on their whole military. And this became clear in this fire, as we have National Guard troops with their guns pointed at Mexicans now carrying guns in Qualcomm Stadium. The same people who are supposed to prevent people from coming in are now supposed to protect them. We see this characterization, this divide taking place in terms of San Diego. For low-income workers out in East County of all ethnicities, for Native Americans on reservations who are unexplainedly left behind and forced to save each other, the Native American tribes, and of course the what amounts to millions of undocumented peoples who live in the shadows from here, from Los Angeles to the Mexican border. I want to point out a few things that were identified. Mike pointed out some of the more egregious aspects of how immigrant workers were persecuted during this, but I want to point out a few more. What the media left out. Aside from the family that was divided and deported from Qualcomm Stadium, what happened almost immediately after that was all evacuation centers implemented requirement for IDs in order to receive food aid. Not only that, but law enforcement, different types of law enforcement, essentially colonized these evacuation centers. And after the, in essence, to enforce the idea of IDs being checked before people can receive their aid, And so beginning with the process of the family being deported, two things happened. We have the militarization of evacuation, and we have, spreading almost as fast as the fires, the fear amongst these communities of people who hear about these things and feel lost, feel helpless. Families after this event were ejected from Qualcomm and other evacuation centers. And sometimes, in some cases, they were rousted in the middle of the night while they were sleeping, asked if they had ID, and if they didn't, they were escorted out. Others were kept from coming in. Others in Qualcomm actually went and hid in their cars, right? They didn't leave their cars. They slept in their cars in the parking lot for fear that if they stayed in the stadium, they might be identified. And for those of us who went to Qualcomm to actually try to document this, one thing that stood out in our minds is how people were treated like less than human if they didn't speak English. There was virtually no resources set aside for people who spoke Spanish or other languages. And they were shuttled about, often told that there was nothing available for them. These are documented cases. This stands in sharp contrast to something that I was quite impressed with and something that didn't make it into the UT, surprisingly enough, which is the way the Latino community pulled together during this time of crisis. So while people were being persecuted for being Latino, for speaking Spanish, for being undocumented, people in the community of Barrio Logan and other environs pulled together to do their part to help their fellow San Diegans. Even before Qualcomm was even understood as a main evacuation point, people from around Barrio Logan decided they were going to set up their own station for collecting and distributing food aid. After the Qualcomm incident, they decided to distribute it without going through Qualcomm or Red Cross, but delivering it directly to the people who needed it, regardless of nationality, ethnicity, or anything else. What amounted to over 100 truckloads of goods were distributed by a bustling group of volunteers who came together, people from the community, people from the campuses, people who didn't think twice about the need to participate and help out. Many immigrants, many undocumented peoples brought what they had to share to help in the relief efforts. But we didn't hear about this. We don't hear about this side of the community. We only hear the criminalization. This tremendous act of solidarity inspired everybody who participated. It also inspired the Minutemen to take action. While we were out there, we were invaded. We were invaded by small groups of hateful individuals who decided that they couldn't stand the fact that this community was pulling together and trying to help out. It didn't fit into their image that they're trying to create of the quote-unquote criminal alien. So while we were under watch constantly and often intimidated by the police, in my case, for instance, they took pictures of me and were trying to intimidate me. Under the watchful eye of the police, the Minutemen drove around, harassed people. In fact, in one case, they accused the people who collected the donations of having looted them from elsewhere in order to redistribute them. And this just shows both their racism and their weakness and cowardliness. These two acts, you know, show to me the contrast of how the community responded. And not only the outpouring of support from the local communities, but also from Mexico. A lot of it was underreported how Mexico actually contributed. So, for instance, Mexico sent several fire engines and fire crews to help support the efforts. They also supplied emergency energy. After the fires cut a main power link that links East County to Arizona, and after a main power link that links San Diego to the rest of California was threatened, they supplied emergency energy. And I thought this was kind of interesting because the Tecate's fire department director told the Associated Press after, you know, why are you helping? And he said something I thought was quite amazing. Well, it's very important for the people of Mexico to cooperate with the people of the U.S. in situations like these because we live together.
That was Justin Chacon, professor of history and Chicano studies at the City College of San Diego, whose report on community solidarity brings us nicely to our final segment, the next installment of our reading on the gift economy from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. In the section we heard last week, Vaughn explained how the nurturing, gift-giving model of social relations that stems from the mothering paradigm has been captured and rendered invisible by the patriarchal family and economic structure. She called for the reorganization of governments to put these nurturing values at the center of society. not by co-opting them in welfare schemes that ultimately serve to degrade and humiliate those they purport to help, but by ridding our institutions of competition for dominance, so that individuals and relatively small groups could take part in nurturing one another. A transformation of this sort, she said, would also require the creation of abundance through the cessation of waste. Present scarcity, she argued, is being artificially created through waste spending on products that do not nurture life. And these expenditures deplete the economy of the many in order to allow the continuation of patriarchal socioeconomic systems of exploitation and the overprivileging and power of the few. Throughout, she's placed great emphasis on language, both as a medium of gift-giving and the vehicle that forms our thoughts about social relations, including the formation of gender, the roles and values assigned to people on the basis of their sex. We'll continue in Chapter 6 with the section Genderless Categories. Vaughan writes, though communism may be seen as an attempt to satisfy needs, it has been undermined, like capitalism, by patriarchal structures. Marx and other male economists up to the present day did not understand women's free labor as value-producing work. If women's work were counted, we would have to add on at least 40% to the GNP of most Western countries, more to third world countries. Economists who leave aside such macroscopic elements must be skewing their analyses. As if a student of the solar system were to leave aside 40% of the planets, she would have to find other explanations for their effects, irregularities in orbits, for example, and would not be able to map an itinerary for successful space travel. Feminism is a more complete analysis, deeper and farther reaching, and a better basis for social planning than communism or capitalism, because unlike them, it gives value to free labor. Even when we talk about the good, or justice, which seems like unmarked and gender-neutral terms, we still have males as the unacknowledged models. The good is loaded with images of male god figures, while justice usually depends upon male judges and male law. The value given to equality, which is an important factor in the one-many concept form, and a main principle of masculation and exchange, also perpetuates the male model. Mothers nurture babies who are different from them, not equal. The male images and actors bring with them the values they have been given socially, including the privilege of their mark. Moreover, the seemingly neutral categories are given a nobility as categories to which we should try to belong. They are a sort of artificial, unmarked state of being, a broader norm to which little boys who had to leave the category of their mothers can, as adults, strive to return, without going through the terrors of the illusory need for castration. By behaving according to the laws, commandments, rules, and regulations of the fathers, they can become similar to their fathers and brothers, who are not really different from their mothers in this, since the rules are valid for all, even though the males have more authority. By this, boys, as they become adults, can partly divest themselves of the invented differences that ruined their primordial integrity, the wholeness and identification with their mothers, the original true experience they had to deny when they found out they belonged to the other category. Their mothers and other females are, quote, raised to a level of equality with them, following the same rules and supposedly having the same privileges. The neutral, objective, unbiased categories promise a sort of utopia to which children can aspire if they behave correctly, or if all people behave correctly. By acting in such a way that we can belong to the category of good, or even Democrat or American, we seem to have a chance to overcome the original estrangement due to the mark or lack of the mark, the gender difference. I want to insist here that this sad journey is unnecessary because the original estrangement is unnecessary. It is the social interpretation of gender that estranges the little boy from his mother because of his mark. And we can change a social interpretation. The little boy is really a member of the category of the human, with the gift-giving mother as model, as is the little girl. And the mark really is irrelevant to the category of the human from the beginning. Adults socialize children into these roles, both by their own behavior and by actively telling the child he is a boy, pushing him towards his father's identity, away from the interactive, gift-giving identity he experiences every day with his mother. The problem is even worse if the father is not available at all, but the child only sees other men on the street or perhaps on television. We adults divide his conceptual identity from his experience. He's just trying to use language with regard to himself as he uses it with regard to other things to understand what they are. Similarly, a little girl learns from society that the category to which she and her mother belong is inferior, that it is often not even visible as a category, that her mother, who is still her model, probably values the male with his mark more than she does her daughter, herself, or her gender. Another effect of masculation is that privilege of one kind or another appears connected to a mark. Money, cars, possessions function as marks of class. Skin color, height, and other physical differences function as marks of racial or cultural categories. But all of these dynamics originate from the phallic mark and from defining the boy's difference from his mother as a physical difference. They promote the idea of a privileged deviant, that it may appear that we should behave in a masculated obsessive way because we are connected to or own a mark. Money, for instance, like the phallus, is the mark which appears to identify the norm. It disqualifies the gift-giving norm, whose place it has taken, making those who do not have it inferior. Other kinds of biological characteristics, like white skin, can function as the culturally imposed mark of the norm, interpreting other skin colors as lacking or less normal categories. We all act according to our definitions just as boys and girls do. We blindly follow the self-fulfilling prophecies of the names of our categories, which bring with them the erroneous social readings of our physical and non-physical differences. Or we have to grapple with the prophecies and contradict them. It would be much easier to change the definitions than it is to change the lives and social patterns that have already been distorted in their image. Both women and men can learn, and many already are doing so, to speak to children from a meta level about gender, telling them something like, the words we use to talk about ourselves are not quite right. We are a little different from the way it sounds. Even though we say male and female, boy and girl, mommy and daddy, we are all human. We are really all part of the same category. In fact, when children are small, they have to also overlook some other major physical differences, such as size, in order to be able to grasp the category human and themselves as part of it. Surely they are open-minded enough to overlook the difference in genitals for their definition if we don't impose it upon them. Listen to how people talk with young children about gender. With clothes on, boy and girl babies look very much alike, and the gender is the first thing people ask about. Is it a baby boy or a girl? Even the practice of distinguishing babies according to the colors they are dressed in, pink and blue, is misleading. We should not impose stereotypes upon our children, but rather allow them to grow up through gift-giving interactions and to become conscious of what they are as they grow. Perhaps we should allow children to choose their gender at puberty according to sexual preference, enhancing their choices with rituals and celebrations. Distinguishing sexes according to the color of their clothes is like distinguishing and privileging races according to the color of their skin. We should not burden them with a self-fulfilling prophecy which alienates them from us and from themselves. We may think children are not smart enough or logical enough to catch these distinctions, but if that is the case, it is probably because we have confused them from the beginning by loading the terms of their identities with such difficult and false differences. We are not only doing this individually, it is a part and product of the whole misogynist social drift. Categorization itself has become a tool of oppression linked with the economic evaluation of everything according to its price. But gift-giving and need satisfaction are more important than categorization for the well-being of humanity. Categorization has just been distorted and overemphasized as a consequence of masculation. We could also avoid masculation by abolishing gender terms altogether for children. We could call children hums, for instance, short for humans. We could say, "How's my little hum?" to the question, "Is your baby a boy or girl?" We could reply, "He's a hum." Or perhaps we could just hum. Maybe adults could finally begin to refer to ourselves that way as well. This would solve the problem of separation-based masculated identity, of the definition of females as inferior, and of the over-evaluation of the neuter or objective by not imposing false distinctions in the first place. The penis is not a special gift or mark of a superior category. It is only a body part. I do not mean by this to take the positive and life-enhancing character from sexual differences, but to liberate them from the stereotypes, and especially from the obsession of masculation that is murdering us and our Mother Earth. It is perhaps because we cannot hear Earth saying, "You're like me, you are in my gift-giving category," that we have done this. Or is it that we cannot hear her because we have the obsession? As a species, we have defined ourselves as something, man, that is other than the mother, and have to act according to our self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, we have done the same thing regarding Mother Earth that we have done as little boys regarding our human mothers. We have denied our similarity and identified ourselves as something else, but we don't quite know what it is, so we end up identifying with the word itself. Our sample seems to be a male god, a lot like us, up in the sky and bigger and more important than the mother. We try to act according to what he tells us to do, invent a hierarchical great chain of being, of overtaking and giving way, and forget about the gift-giving impulses of our hearts. Trusted and allowed to play according to their own lights, however, children become enormously intelligent and creative, as Maria Montessori discovered. We need to let our definitions of ourselves grow up from our experiences of free activities, play, creativity, interactions of gift-giving, filling our sensitive learning periods with living reality. We should not make our children have to try to become adequate to pre-existing oppositional adult gender categories. All this is easier where there is abundance, and the experience of the child is not blighted by abuse or scarcity. Maybe hum could also stand for humus, part of the earth, the ground which we and our whole cultures are for one another. the foundation from which we grow and to which we return. Maybe we can finally act according to gift-giving in a continuation of the original mother-child situation, which we can finally allow to flower sanely and untwisted in the whole society. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. It's really not difficult to change the language we teach to children. I tried it myself in the 1960s with my oldest child, Amelia. I avoided using the possessive pronoun with her, not teaching her my or mine, his, hers. Since the mother really is the original sample, a child learns from what she says better than from others. I did ask the people who were with us to avoid these possessives also. Of course, Amelia heard them when we were with people we did not know well, on the radio and so forth. I got around the difficulties in these ideas by saying, Daddy uses that, for example, instead of, that's Daddy's. It was interesting that she did not learn possessives until she was around 3, though she was talking well by then. I know how she learned. She wanted to play with some dishes, and another person told her, Don't touch those, they're your mother's. I always felt that the illogical reason, actually she was not supposed to play with them because they would break, not because they were mine. Coupled with the fact that the person who possessed the dishes was me, the mother, finally made my daughter start to use that category. It would be hard to say whether or not learning the possessives made my daughter any more generous than she otherwise would have been, or whether it had any effect at all. In fact, the experiment ended too soon. There were too many variables, and doing it alone was not terribly effective. On the other hand, it didn't hurt her either. Possession is not as basic as gender, and anyway, the fabric of life absorbed any negativity that might have been involved. Avoiding gender terms at an early age, however, could really have a far-reaching effect in children's self-concepts, at least if it was done in their most sensitive language learning periods. We could also use androgynous terms in nursery schools. We could talk to children about gender terms from a meta level on Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. We could give TV examples of mothers and children, boys and girls, using genderless terms to define their categories as part of a common humanity. I believe that here, too, the fabric of life would correct any unknown negatives that might be involved in the experiment. Women have made such a difference in language in the last decades, eliminating sexist terminology. Surely we could devise new ways of talking to and about our children, which would let them continue to identify with us in an ongoing way outside of stereotypical gender concepts. Perhaps all of us could recognize and acknowledge our kinship to each other, to our mothers, and to Mother Earth, returning to the gift-giving norm. And I've been reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn, published in 1999. You can download this entire book for free online and find out more about Vaughn's ideas of the gift economy at gift-economy.com. And you can download this and all other episodes of Unwelcome Guests online at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Come down like an